Welcome to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives, discussing mental health, addiction, and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
Dan Oatridge has been our guest previously on Take It From Us. He's a mental health first aid facilitator for Human X and talks about topics such as depression, anxiety, and substance misuse. Dan is a real enthusiast. He loves to help people through education, but also by sharing his own experiences with anxiety and poor mental well-being. We talk to Dan about how we can help those we love, how to identify when someone we know could be really struggling and what to do, and his best tips for coping with overwhelm. Please be aware this episode of Take It From Us deals with suicide. Look, I've been looking forward to having a chat because you came on our program a couple of years ago now, and you were really vulnerable in telling us about your story and how you've been able to take all of that lived experience and now help people to train them up to be first aid facilitators. You've got a really good handle on depression, anxiety, substance misuse, and we'll get to that as we go. But how have you been in the last couple of years? How's your health been?
Yeah, my physical health has been pretty good. My mental health has been a bit up and down. Just before the lockdown, 2019, I took a role with Lifeline and was with Lifeline for about a year and a half, just under 2 years. And over that period of time, that was quite an intense, as everyone will be aware of, it was quite an intense period of, there was a lot of uncertainty, a lot of people were experiencing a lot of anxiety, a lot of depression, a lot of what we sort of came to, I guess, look at as grief as well. And me being the sort of empathetic soul I am, took a lot of that on. And, you know, as like anything, empathy sort of runs a bit dry sometimes. And so I ended up having to basically step away from the role. I was the national trainer. So I was traveling around New Zealand a bit, talking to various companies about mental health, about stress, about our psychophysiological stress response, which is a nice fancy word for the people there. Talking about like what we can do for it, how do we recognize it, where do we go for support? I mean, needless to say, that was pretty useful for my own mental health as well, not just for other people. But so I left Lifeline in mid sort of late 2022 and got back into the mental health first aid facilitation, which is something that is very near and dear to my heart. Obviously, we had a brief chat about it a little while ago, but there's been a bit of change in that space as well. We've put together, there's been some new programs come out and a few little updates as well in terms of, better sort of more informed treatments, support, better quality statistics, that kind of thing, more up to date. We're sort of rocking and rolling with that, trying to spread the word of some mental health first aid and get more people aware of the program and engaging with it as well.
Yeah, and this program is across 24 countries.
Yeah.
So it's pretty well established now. Would that be right?
It's well established. It's well established, but it's still not very kind of well known. What you'll find is a lot of people think it's a great idea, but a lot of people, there are a few like myself, like Human X, a few sort of independent contractors around the country. So you may have heard about it just from like a different source, but 24 different countries, I think they ticked over a million mental health first aiders a little while ago. So we're probably pushing up maybe 1.5, something like that. My goal was always to get one mental health first aid trained person in every family across New Zealand. So, whatever that works out to be. Recently they have released, there's one that's more sort of youth based. So the standard program is we talk about four main topics. We talk about depression and anxiety. We talk about psychosis and substance misuse or problematic substance use. And so the new one with the youth version has brought in obviously more youth-focused data, more youth-focused scenarios, but also things like eating, you know, information about eating disorders, things that more, I guess, directly affect young people. Maybe, you know, obviously still some adults will find it useful. But the program or this particular workshop is more for like adults who are in front of kids a lot or in front of young people a lot. Like we're talking like sports coaches, maybe teachers, people who don't necessarily have kids or have, you know, any kind of children, but interact with them a lot. And yeah, just giving them some tools to better identify, you know, when someone's struggling, and then basically like, what do I do from there? Because it can be a bit of a, there's a lot of uncertainty there as well. You know, don't want to sort of invade privacy, don't want to offend anyone.
Mm. And also being able to distinguish, is this person in need of mental well-being support, and do I need to intervene or find a way to help, or is this young person just having a bad day?
Yeah.
And they'll probably be okay. Is that part of the discussion that you have to help people identify when someone really could be in trouble as opposed to just a rough day?
Mm. It's and it's funny because especially with like teenagers, you're pretty moody at times, you know, and so
and they catastrophize, right?
Yeah, it's the worst day ever. You're the worst
day of my life. Yeah.
And they say things that you kind of like, oh, that sounds really serious, but like I know my child and they would never do something like that. Yeah, and it's the same with adults as well. Like I sort of go by the motto of like the worst that can happen is they can say no. So you can see something, and I guess it's about if you know people well enough, when they've started to deviate from a baseline, you know, we know our children, we know our friends, we know our family, we know when they're not really having a good day, we know when they're having a good day. It's a little bit more difficult for people we're not so familiar with. So if we see someone, you know, maybe if we're talking about young people even at a place of work, for example, someone who's, you know, normally quite connected, normally quite social, chatty, and suddenly they're not, you know, and you go, oh, that's a little bit strange, but, you know, maybe they are just having a bad day. And they may not have slept well the night before. They may have, I don't know, you know, something happened during the night, whatever. Where that becomes an issue is, I guess, when it becomes more prolonged. So they tend to put like a 2-week sort of time frame on when you see symptoms and then seeking help. You know, depending on how well we know that person, that might be sooner because you know, a couple of days, oh, this is really out of character. Something's really, you know, we need to talk about this. And I guess recognizing is only part of the struggle. The other part is, what do I say? And then, you know, what if, and exactly as you say, what if they are just having a bad day? And I figure, like, the worst someone can say is, like, no, I'm fine. Like, what are you talking about? Which is kind of ironic because that might be the same answer you get from someone who is in need of some support.
Yeah, the fob off, the classic fob off.
Exactly. Yeah, they build the wall, the I'm fine wall, and you need to kind of break through that sometimes. And that's where, you know, when we talk about the approach that we make with mental health first aid and, you know, like there's a time, when's a good time, when's a good place to have this conversation. It may also be one of those like, well, I may need to ask this question a few times before this person actually trusts me enough to open up. You know, during the, I think there's a stat with like midwives asking mothers to be if there's violence in the house, and don't quote me on the stat, but I've heard it sort of up to 7 times, right? So we may need to ask this person, and they might be 15, they might be 25, they might be 60, you know, if they're okay. Like, it might be a few more times, and I'm not sort of saying we pester them once an hour, but it might be like once a day, you know, we check in every couple of days, something like that. If we see things getting worse, you know, that's when we kind of, we might need to intervene a bit quicker. It's part of offering the support is having the courage to ask the question. And it's funny because people are worried about if the person is okay. They go, well, what if they're fine? And they say no and look at me funny. What you should really be worried about is if they say, no, I'm not okay, I need support, because that job's so much harder to do, so much more time consuming and involving. And it's like we're not really worried about the actual reason we're asking this is if we, you know, we want them to know if they're okay. You know, we're worried about is if they're fine.
Like, well, if you think that part of that is that we feel ill-equipped and inadequate to help if, heaven forbid, they say, no, I'm not fine.
Definitely, yeah. And you see the people recoil in horror. Now, one of the, I guess just to get deep real quick, one of the questions that we talk about asking is, are you suicidal? You know, have you been having thoughts of suicide? How long have you been having thoughts of suicide for? You know, have you made a plan? And these are all questions that my wife and I have had. She's asked me numerous times. When she used to travel a lot for work was when I was in a really dark period and made my attempt. And so now when she goes away for work, she likes to know that I'm okay. So should we have this conversation? My answers have changed a lot. Basically, you know, a complete like 180 is their no's now, you know, are you suicidal? No. But there was a time when those answers were yeses. And that's terrifying. It is terrifying to hear someone that you care about say, yes, I'm suicidal. Having the courage to just ask that quick, like it takes a lot. Let alone to sort of the ability to kind of mentally prepare yourself into, well, if they say yes, because we all want them to say no. We, you know, are you suicidal? No, that would be great. But the occasion is yes. And I guess the reality of mental health challenges are that you need to prepare for the fact that someone might say, yeah, I'm suicidal. I need some help. What are we going to do? And like you as the well person in that situation, you know, we're probably packing yourself.
If you're really worried about the person that you've asked that question of and you're not convinced that a no is the truth, what then? It doesn't feel appropriate to say, oh, are you sure?
Mm-hmm.
Like if your instinct is saying, man, I really feel that this person is teetering, have they just given me an honest answer? What do I do now?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a few different answers to that one. There's a few different paths. One path is you can go with your gut feeling and how well you know this person. And you can say, I hear what you're saying, but your eyes are telling me something different. So we can, and then we can go like, can you tell me what's really going on? Another option is if they're an adult, we go, okay, I've asked the question. Here's maybe what I've observed. And they go, look, no, I'm fine. I'm okay. Whatever. And I go, well, you're an adult, but I'm going to leave that door open. Like, look, if there is anything that you ever want to talk about, come and talk to me about it. Like the door's open. You can talk to me, you know. So we don't just slam that thing shut. The other alternative, and this is, I guess, if we are really worried about this person, and I know it sounds strange to talk about someone who's suicidal and varying degrees of worry, but there's some people who are suicidal, they have these thoughts and they manage them and they're not actually going to like physically do anything about it. We obviously still pay attention check in with those people. There are other people who, if we leave them alone, they're going to attempt. So there's, you know, a little bit of degree of kind of urgency there. further down this more severe end is like, we don't leave them alone. If in doubt, that's when we call the ambulance or the crisis team. Or, you know, this could be something that they've been through before. It may not be the first time. So if they have, one thing that is quite handy is a safety plan. And you can find, you can either just, I guess, draw one up from Google or whatever. But the Mental Health Foundation has a bunch of awesome resources on their website, and that you can get, I guess, digitally or sent to you for free in, you know, hard copy. And one of them is a safety plan. And basically the safety plan is, I mean, it's a blueprint for what happens if this person ends up, you know, suicidal again. We call this person, we do this, we call that person, and like me as maybe the supporter and the person who experiences these thoughts or is unwell, and those involved, we all agree, and we all basically it takes a lot of the fear out of this thing happening again, because I know what to do now. And so that can be really comforting for a lot of people as well, both the person who might be suicidal and the person or people who have to, who want to support them as well. But yeah, I mean, we generally say, like, if in doubt, it's, you know, call crisis team, call the, you know, police at the last kind of resort. But hopefully what things like mental health first aid can do is provide a bit of a conduit and some kind of tools to help manage that, because we can't always get to the crisis team straight away. We can't always get to the police straight away, unfortunately. So, yeah, it's sort of things like trying to remove anything they can hurt themselves with, not leaving them alone, you know, a couple of the more basic things that we can do, yeah.
And I guess if they are alone and you can't get to them, it might be that you just stay on the phone with them as long as you possibly can.
Absolutely. We, you know, with Lifeline, they occasionally need to do like welfare checks with some of the service users or the callers. And essentially, yeah, it's about, you know, trying to keep the person talking. And a lot of the time with suicide and suicidal thoughts, it's like a momentary thing. Yes, some people have them for long periods of time, but there's periods where it's sort of overwhelming, and then that's like what the sort of result of it is. And so a lot of the time with, especially with some of the you know, the people who call Lifeline, is about getting them through that 10 or 15 minutes until they can de-escalate or kind of bring the mood down a little bit. And then, you know, we can move forward from there. And it's a bit more of an acute thing. But, yeah, I mean, like physical first aid, it's sort of when in doubt, call 111, basically, because it's sort of better to have called them and not need them than, you know, need them and not call them a lot of the time.
Yeah. So there's been a special program, you've mentioned this, developed for young people over the last couple of years. And we've talked a lot about the mental well-being issues that young people are experiencing.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's really scary, the number of young people around the world who are struggling.
Yep.
What, and we've covered off, we know that there will be depression and anxiety big time for youth and substance misuse and other things. What are you hearing from the young people that you talk to? Like, what sort of issues are they primarily coming to you with, and what is it that you need to be aware of as a facilitator to help others understand this?
Finding a place in society is quite. So I've talked with a lot of parents of young kids or young people, you know, teenagers, that kind of thing. And I mean, I guess everything that you hear, all the sort of rumors on the street, cost of living crisis, mental health crisis, climate crisis, all that stuff, is it all kind of piles on to the anxiety for these young people. That, you know, everyone wants to have a future for themselves. And I guess, you know, you look at from their perspective and it could look fairly bleak as well. And so, I mean, what do you tell them? Like, without dismissing the, you know, their worries and their troubles, because that's sort of a, you know, it's not really constructive. I grew up with nuclear testing in Mururoa Atoll. And so we had, that was our climate crisis, right? And I was, I don't know, 10 years old or something when it was going on. And I mean, not a lot really happened from that. I don't want to get too much into whether, you know, the sort of the two sides of all this stuff, but I find that, to be completely honest, I found that unplugging from a lot of social media, unplugging from the news, unplugging from, other than like a very light filtering of it, was incredibly helpful for me, because it does, it gets at you. It's just constant negative, negative, negative. And then you, there's no like respite from it. And I found, especially with anxiety, that, and I think you yourself used the word the struggle. And a lot of, and I used to refer to these things myself as like a similar way, the struggle of this and the fight. And I know it might sound a little bit kind of basic, but I found that a simple reframe is actually quite useful, and has been really helpful for me. Doesn't solve everything, and it still gets hard at times. But I've actually chosen to not refer to these things as a struggle or a fight, the same way that I've chosen not to refer to someone who dies by suicide as committed suicide.
Yeah.
I've chosen to refer to I live with anxiety now. I live with depression, and I'm probably getting slightly digressing.
So it's affirmative. You're using affirmative language rather than judge. It's a discernment as opposed to a judgment.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fact that, like, and this is, I guess, what gets me with a lot of young people and anxiety, especially the other sort of mental illnesses. Depression's a bit of a different thing. It's constant fear and terrified of this thing. Makes you feel really uncomfortable. Anyone who's experiencing anxiety out there probably knows the feeling of either a panic attack, an anxiety attack. Most people will know what it's like to be nervous about something, whatever that may be. And you might even know what it's like to be like really like worried about something or somebody. What a lot of people don't sort of link with is, and this is part of that affirming it, is that anxiety is actually a part of humans. It's why humans have survived to this point. And it's actually good for us to experience some of this stuff. Problem with nowadays is that it's what sets off the anxiety and when the anxiety triggers that become the problem. We're not being chased by, you know, maybe lions and tigers and woolly mammoths and things anymore. But our email goes off at 7 a.m. and that spikes the anxiety, or, you know, you hear the text message come through at 10 o'clock at night and that's something, you know, the work sound or something. So, or that guy cuts us off driving to work, you know, and that spikes the anxiety. I've sort of come from a place where, like, I've tried to ignore this like a bloke does. We ignore shit, ignore it, and it goes away.
We ignore it and we fix it.
Yeah, exactly. And the craziest thing about that was it didn't work. So I didn't know what to do. And I was like, well, if ignoring it didn't work, I guess I should try to medicate it. Medicating it didn't work, right? And so that led to essentially my suicide attempt. So I tried to sort of end my life. That didn't work either, right? And I apologize if I say that kind of lightly. But I tried all this stuff. And so what I found was that it was just like this constant waging of war every day and hating it and just feeling exhausted every day. Next day I wake up, everything's the same. And I go straight back to war. Nowadays I will go like, I'll wake up at sort of 5 and be like, that's the anxiety waking me up. Better get up and do something, you know, instead of like tossing and turning. But it's the sort of acceptance that this thing's with me. Fighting it doesn't work. So how can I make it work for me? And that's actually been like quite a, life-changing kind of thing for me, because now I still experience all the stuff. It's all still really uncomfortable. But that fear of, I'm like, well, I know I'm doing a podcast with, you know, Take It From Us, or I'm doing a workshop for, you know, whatever. I'm going to be up in front of a bunch of people, going to feel a bit uncomfortable, probably going to perspire a little bit, probably going to feel a little bit nervous in the tummy. That's all the anxiety. Here's the reasons why that's all happening. And I just make accommodations for where I can. And it's suddenly it's not so scary anymore, which is, I mean, it not like being terrified of how your body's going to react to something is an incredible feeling. Still gets me occasionally, you know, it's not sort of quite there, but I, you know, it's just as simple as changing something to, you know, I live with it instead of I'm fighting against it, all about the reinforcing the correct neural pathways, that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, it seems to be working well at this stage.
I often suggest to people, hey, convince yourself that you're excited rather than anxious. Because often when we're anxious, it's because we care and we want to do well. Yep. And we want to put our best selves forward. And so the symptoms are exactly the same as being excited. Heart rate goes up, pupils dilate, we start to sweat a little bit, we get a little bit tense in the jaw, whatever it might be. That often works. I know it does for me. When I get nervous in front of a big group of people, I just say, Kent, you're excited, you're ready to go, let's do it, man. And that can help. I was just thinking too about the young people and the comparisons. Mm-hmm. Young people these days find it very difficult to disattach from comparison. Because they are filling their heads full of content continuously. Look, I'm 47 and I am aware that I do this. If I'm not watching a video, I'm listening to a podcast. If I'm not listening to a podcast, I'm watching some form of entertainment somewhere else. The news, it's all consuming and it gets too much. You jump on Facebook, you jump on LinkedIn, whatever it might be, you can't help but compare yourself. We're a little bit older, so we grew up in an age where there was no social media, there was no cell phones. We did not have the most addictive device ever invented on our beings the entire time. So we've got just a little bit more built-in ability to cope with this change. Young people don't. Are you noticing that? Is this what they're telling you?
Yes, as you say, the comparison thing gets me as well. I do my best to just remind myself, comparison is the thief of joy. That's just a phrase that I live by. I absolutely love that thing. And you know, the hardest part, or the thing that kind of really gets me, is when you're comparing yourself to someone like 10 years younger who's done all this stuff, and you go, wow, you're 30 and you're 40 or you're 20 and you've done all this crazy, you've lived 100 years in 20 years or something. The comparison, so in the midst of my like really dark period, you kind of lose track of time. And in this period of time, I've often said the world doesn't stop just because you're having a bad day. And the comparison for me now is comparing myself to my friends who are same age, you know, did all the same stuff, but they've got, you know, kids, the house, you know, the car, the really nice career and all this stuff. And I go, man, I wish I was, you know, why can't I be there? Why aren't I like that? And nowadays I'm like, well, I still have the kind of that I wish, but at the same time, like I've just traveled a different path, you know? And I'm sure there's a dude with a couple of kids who's going, man, I wish that guy, I'm, you know, jealous of that guy with no kids. Yeah.
No, you're right. Exactly. I've got two kids. I love them to bits. I wouldn't change any of it, but I would be lying if I said to you, I've never had envy for the single man who only has to look after himself.
Yeah.
That would be a lie.
Yeah.
But the envy now makes me laugh and it passes in the blink of an eye.
Yeah.
But I know what you're saying. And do you really want that successful person that we look up to or see as a peer who we should aspire to be more like? Do we really know what's going on in the background? Do we know what happens behind that person's doors at night? Do we really want their life?
Hey, man.
Do we really want the stress and the worry and the responsibility and the pressure that comes with being super successful and having a boat and a bloody BMW? Do you really want that?
It's what's the song? My money, my problems. You know, it's that. And if recent events with certain celebrities have taught me anything, is no, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes. Everyone's got their own struggle, but I do think social media needs to come with an instruction manual, certainly for younger kids, because none of it's real. Even the people that say I'm doing this because I want to be real, that's still not real.
It's
real.
Performative. It comes back to having to be performative. Are you actually truly authentic when you go on social media?
Yeah.
Like even me, right? I post from time to time. I don't like to do much of it, Dan, but I know when I do that, I'm having to be performative. Part of me just tweaks, just changes. Yep. Is that truly the authentic Kent on there, even though I'm trying really hard to be? It's no different to being recorded. When you know you're being recorded, when you're on film, you act differently.
Hell yeah, you say a lot different. Yeah, exactly. With young people, I guess it's more of just that sort of reinforcement of like, this isn't real. A lot of that comes from yourself as well. You kind of have to tell yourself that. But in order to do that, in order to really realize how insignificant social media really is, you just need to take an hour off it. You know, go to the gym, leave the phone at home or whatever, go for a walk in the park for an hour and get some sun on your face and see, you know, it really doesn't matter. But I do have to chuckle. You walk around the place these days and you see people's heads down looking at phones and I'll come home. Oh mate, it's so bad. I was at the hospital waiting room the other day for this kidney stone op, and just everyone staring down at their phone and no one even looking up, seeing what's going on. And you know, there's a lot out there that's quite beautiful, and you're sort of missing it all. If there was one sort of piece of advice I could give to young people about social media, it's really just about how fake it is. And even as real as someone makes it, it's still a contrived kind of manufactured, perception of whatever it is they're trying to sell you, essentially. And comparing yourself to a Photoshop, it's the same deal. Like we have, back in the 90s, it was comparing yourself to the swimsuit models or the dudes in the muscle magazines or, you know, Arnold Schwarzeneggers of the world, that kind of stuff. It's all fake Photoshopped or steroid infused or something in the end, you know? I don't know. Go on outside and spend some time outside and, you know, in nature, and you kind of realize where the real beauty of the world is. And
what's the most rewarding part of your role as a mental health first aid facilitator?
Getting to share some of the knowledge. I tell you, one of the coolest feelings that I've ever had with doing this work was I had a mum and dad come to one of our workshops, and their son had just been in a single person car crash. And they were really, really worried that, I was going to use a different word, they were really worried that it was a suicide attempt. And they didn't know how to approach this. They didn't know how to ask their son what was going on. They just were really concerned. I think from memory, like the son wasn't too, some scrapes and bruises, but he was kind of okay. But they obviously were still worried. So we were talking over a lunch break, and one sort of technique that I've come to learn in terms of giving information to people is like a drop and run kind of scenario where take home some pamphlets and stuff. You know, they took a bunch on depression and anxiety and substance misuse and all that kind of stuff. And they just sort of left them on their kitchen counter at home. And they came back the next week, because it was like a Saturday and then a Saturday workshop. They came back the next week, and mum's being mum's, she sort of came up to me and she's like, I was cleaning my son's room. Son's 20 something, you know, I was just cleaning my son's room. It's like, God bless mums. She says, I found one of the pamphlets in his bedroom. It was beside his bed or on his desk or whatever it was. And the look on her face was so, I don't know, she was stoked, but she was like really like optimistic as well. And there was like this really, there was some hope there. And that was really choice, because I don't know whether it was a suicide attempt or not. I have no idea what's happened with them now, because, you know, leave on day two and you never kind of see them again. But the fact that they didn't move this thing, and one of these pamphlets went from the kitchen to this kid's room, is about as sort of hopeful as you can get, you know. And so it's the little I often say, like, how many people do St. John first aid but have never had to administer CPR to anyone, right? Most times people will come back to day two of these workshops and go, oh, yeah, I had a chat with insert whoever it was here. They were really struggling and I used our, you know, the action plan that we talk about, or some of the like the skills and tools that we talk about to like approach this person and say like, are you okay? And they said no. And we had this really good discussion about what was going on. And you know, now they're going to see EAP or, you know, a counselor or something like that. I mean, those stories are, if I had a dollar for every one of those, I'd be a very rich man. But one of the more touching ones that still kind of gets me is we had a butcher who, as butchers can possibly be, he didn't really know a lot about anything about mental health and this kind of stuff. And he came along because it was a bit of a, I don't know, he just wanted to know some stuff. But I touched base with him a little while after the workshop, and he goes, mate, my son's and his partner had a premature baby, and it was like quite premature, and it was sort of touch and go there for a bit. And he's like, my son called me up and I didn't know what to say, and so I just listened. And he goes, I wouldn't have known what to listen before. And it was the sweetest moment. It choked me up, because I was just like, there's this dude covered in the blood of animals with a cleaver in his hand talking about getting really deep and sensitive with his son over like a premature newborn baby. It was beautiful. But there's little moments like that that I'm like, man, this stuff really needs to be everywhere, because it's something that you're going to use whether you know you're using it or not. And I mean, as I said,
great skills.
Yeah.
Really, really great skills for all of us to have. Hey, Dan, nice to chat to you. Thanks very much for coming on again.
No worries.
Talk to us and keep up the good work. And I'm really glad to hear that you know that you're making a difference.
Yeah, appreciate that, Kent. Yeah, it's great to be here. And hopefully we can see some of the listeners on these workshops maybe.
Take It From Us is produced by Karen Murphy. Our sound engineer is Paul Hannon from Planet FM. And I'm your host, Kent Johns. Please get in touch with us on Facebook. We'd love to hear from you.
You're listening to Take It From Us. My story, your story, our story.
Stream it. Listen on demand. Pod it. Your favourite shows are waiting on planetaudio.org.nz.
Whether you call it Aotearoa, New Zealand, New Zealand, or Nova Zelandia, it's worth knowing the history of the place most of us call home. Starting 100 million years ago and bringing us right through to modern day, the Aotearoa History Show explores some of the forces that have shaped this land and its people, from the geographical to the social and political. Produced by RNZ, the Aotearoa History Show airs here on 104.6 Planet FM every Monday at 2:35 p.m. And you can hear the full series anytime online by visiting the series and podcasts page at rnz.co.nz or using your favourite podcasting app.
Feeling overwhelmed by anxiety, stress, burnout, hard to ground yourself or focus on a task? Mantra yoga is a lifeline for the body and mind. Do you want to improve your alertness, improve your nervous system, your health, and express yourself properly? Join us every Tuesday from 9 p.m. on 104.6 Planet FM or listen online at planetaudio.org.nz Mantra Yoga.
Wild beaches,
the number of restaurants.
I love cycling around the waterfront.
Seeing the sea and knowing that it's full of dolphins and whales.